thank you very much for talking to us today, Michael.
Pleasure.
Great to have you on the podcast, and great to have another one of your films in our cinemas. It's always a treat when we get Michael Winterbottom film on the big screen.
Thank you.
Greed feels like a pretty big one in terms of your sort of filmography of the last few years. Did it feel like that when you were working on it?
It was big in the sense it was quite complex to make. Mm. And we have a large cast of characters, especially in the kind of party sequences. Sort of the spine of the film is Rich MacReady, who's played by Steve Coogan, is trying to put on this lavish party and invite lots of his celebrity mates over to make him look good, to make him look like the king of the high street again, because he had some problems. And so that sort of staging that was quite difficult. There's a lot of people there. And we had a great cast. We had like David Mitchell, Isla Fisher, Asim Chowdhury, Sarah Soleimani, Tim Keyes, Ace Butterfield, Sophie Cookson. Shirley Henson. Mm. So managing all that was quite complex. And then the film juxtaposes lots of different worlds. So we had that month in Mykonos, but then we were filming in Britain, we were filming in London, then we were into Leicester, we were filming in Monaco, we filmed in Sri Lanka. So it was busy. I'm not sure, you know, it wasn't big in sense of expensive, but it was busy.
The multiple locations and some of those really big names. It's got the sort of wow factor on a big screen.
I hope so. It's like what was great is like, you know, especially like all those people like from that kind of comedy world coming to do their stuff, you know, makes it, from my point of view as a director, makes it great, you know, to have people who are really good at what they do, and you can sort of let them go on with it and hope they're good and hope they're funny.
That must be pretty good, actually. I mean, safe hands here.
Exactly.
Let them do their thing. I wanted to ask just how long has this film been with you? Is this something you've been sort of burning to do for a little while?
Well, it felt like it was quite quick. Films always take a long time, and weirdly, I was looking at my computer the other day, and it was like I think the first script might have been as early as 2014 or 15, which it just seems like, well, I'm sure it wasn't that long, because it all went about as smoothly as making a film can go. But films take a while, so the starting point was around the time when Philip Green was before the Select Committee, which I can't remember what that day said. I haven't checked it. And a journalist, Peter Oborn, I was talking to him about Syria, a completely different thing, and he was just saying a few funny stories about Philip Green calling him up and ranting down the phone at him if he got a story wrong, and so it just made him seem like a funny character, and so that was the start, and so it's all gone pretty quick, but it's still quite a long time, and the films are just very slow to put together.
And obviously there's a lot of parallels with real life events in this film. Do you do a lot of research when sort of preparing and writing this picture?
Yeah, we did a lot of research just like in terms of reading up stuff. And there was a book called Top Man that we sort of we used quite a lot, which was written about Philip Green. But then also just more general research on sort of retail fashion, which wasn't a world I knew that much about. So that was really interesting. From the starting idea of like, okay, there's this character, this type of character, who could be funny. It was like then looking at the world of retail fashion, it kind of felt like, yeah, okay, that's really can be worth doing, because, you know, it's a massive industry. So there's tens of millions of women workers, mainly in countries like Sri Lanka, where we filmed, but also, you know, Bangladesh, Myanmar, Vietnam, where the workers are getting paid very low wages working for international brands. You know, they're not employed directly by the brands, they're employed by the factories, but the brands kind of set the prices, and then the factories have to make them for these low prices. So there's these tens of millions of women making the clothes, but then the owners of the brands that sell them, whether it's H&M or Zara, are fabulously wealthy billionaires, like a handful of these billionaires men at the top of the tree, and then all these women working at the bottom. It just felt like that's a kind of great industry to look at kind of inequality in general.
I think you do a really good job in the film as well, because it's a complex situation. Various chains at work there, but you do a really good job of distilling it into, you know, an entertaining film. Was that a challenge to sort of get the hard-hitting real-life facts into what is, you know, was also quite a funny movie at times?
Yeah, I wanted to cross-cut in a way between different worlds. You know, I think because you know, the women in Sri Lanka are intimately connected with the billionaire on his yacht in Monaco, you know, because they're making the clothes which he's making all his money from. So there is a real connection to the real world, but it's one that's like usually hidden, it's invisible. You can't imagine there is a connection between these two places. They seem so different. Their lives are so different. Mm. And that seems to be the point. You know, it's like that. You know, it's sort of grotesque in a way that these people, these women are generating the things that are generating the profit of these guys. So the idea was like to cross-cut between these different things, and I hope that would give it a sort of energy. And we use David Mitchell's character, who's the sort of biographer of Rich McCready to sort of as a one sort of device in order to articulate it, so we can go backwards and forwards in time. And we have the party as the central sort of present tense of what's going on and the preparations for the party, and is the party going to work? And then we can cross cut in time, and then also kind of move between different places. So we have it's quite device, it's quite sort of mechanical in structure. It's a bit like a kind of farce where one door opens, another door closes. But it kind of thought that could be be fun itself, and in a way it's like. I like the idea that there would be these gear shifts, that it's like, it's not like it's all one thing. It's like the world of the rich boss is very, very different to the world of the woman worker, and the world of, you could in a sense remind people that by cross-cutting between these different places and different textures, obviously when we're filming with the women, they're real women workers, when we're filming with the Syrian refugees on the beach, they're real refugees. Mm. By having these different textures, you could kind of have like, on the one hand, a kind of farcical kind of comedy of errors, and on the other hand, these reminders that actually this is real and true, and that the real world is actually more ludicrous, and that those shifts might be good rather than being bad. And let's hide them. Let's try and amplify them.
Absolutely, I think comedy is sort of heightened when you have these hard hitting facts, and it makes you think, makes you care about the situation people are in. When you're going to the textile factories, was that sort of an easy shoot? Was it easy to get access to them and to take part? What was the response like from the owners of those factories?
We worked with people in Sri Lanka who helped organise our access, so they did a good job in the first place. But I have to say, I think one thing, I don't know when it comes out in the film or not, but I think when you read articles in this area, when you read there's general kind of concerned journalist articles in this area about the way in which the retail fashion works, there's often a slight implication that The brands are doing their best, but it's hard to keep track of the supply chain. And the implication is always like, it's the bosses in Bangladesh, it's the local bosses in Bangladesh or Myanmar or Sri Lanka that are the problem. They're the ones who are really greedy or mean, and they're the ones who are really cheating the system. But when we talked to the owners of the factories that we filmed in and other ones that we looked at, and the managers, their perspective is that all the international brands come to them and say, and if they're making a kind of item of clothing, say shirt, moment for a dollar, the brands come to them and say, well, look, I can get it for 90 cents in Bangladesh, I can get it for 85 cents in Myanmar, so can you bring your prices down? So they felt squeezed by the brands, because obviously it's an indirect relationship, they're just setting a price and they're trying to meet it. But obviously if you want to get something cheaper, really with clothing, either the factory owners get the women to work faster or they get them to work cheaper. That isn't really a way of reducing the price apart from that. So the brands are really, it's the market, it's like the overall market, the way the market works, but which is, the market that the international brands are benefiting from, is that they keep shifting. They just keep threatening every country, every supplier is saying, well, we can get cheaper somewhere else. So the prices are just driven lower and lower.
And yeah, I think you deliver that information in the film in a really concise montage. But it makes it absolutely clear, sort of how those brands put their pressure on these owners.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like, and the sad thing, I think, is that probably like almost anyone in the fashion industry would be quite happy for the women to get paid. I'm not sure. I don't think they're all evil people. I think, great, we can get someone to work for, $3.50 a day rather than $3.60 a day or whatever. But at the same time, the sort of everyone feels like, well, the market just needs to be regulated. Basically, we need collectively to have some political will to say we can change this. It wouldn't be that hard to change it, I think.
No, absolutely. When you're putting this on together and you come up with a character of Sir Richard McCready, and then you bring it to Steve Coogan, what was his response?
Well, with Steve in the past, everything's really been like from the point of view of like thinking about things to do with Steve. So it's always been the very beginning. So in this case, Rich McCready did exist as a character, and it was and all that has happened, that, so Steve came in and sort of read it, which is not normally the situation. Normally, like with Steve, so I've done with Steve, we talk about it before it's written.
Oh, wow.
But fortunately, he liked it, which is good. And, he's great. I think, he's like, I think his version of Rich is a really enjoyable version of Rich.
Yeah, it's something new for us to see from Steve, but also he gets to play with some great comic work in there, and he gets to be quite mean at times. Like, it's an interesting character.
Yes, it's just a version of himself, really.
You also got this amazing costume for McCready, both sort of physical with the teeth, with the tan, but also, I mean, the idea of the whole sort of gladiator-centric party is kind of genius.
Yeah, the Roman theme party was like good. It was sort of That sort of came quite early on that it'd be quite good that the sort of strand, central strand of it would be the party, and the Roman theme party seemed good. And to be honest, I've seen, so we then borrowed quite a lot from Gladiator the film as well, which my son's like watched probably about 30 times, so I've ended up watching about 15 times. So that's definitely an area of my personal expertise, and so you know it sort of felt like it just felt like it would suit Steve's kind of picture of himself, that he could be the emperor.
He gets to be he does grand and a little bit pompous very well.
we had a little bit in the scripts originally. I think so we sort of lost it where he sort of at some point realized that Russell Crowe isn't actually the emperor and that maybe he wanted to be Russell Crowe, but somehow that disappeared out of the film.
You could sort of believe that character would think that.
Yeah, it's a major.
And you also got it was really nice as a fan of Steve's work to see Tim Key alongside him in this. Did that come naturally or was that from Steve?
No. I mean, Steve's a big fan of Tim, so in that sense it was like good. But no, I met Tim and obviously like seeing him in all the stuff he's done, and thought it'd be great. You know, and we had a great cast, Emily. You know, Sarah Soleimani, who briefly been another film I did with Steve about Paul Raymond, and you know, he's obviously brilliant at what she does. Asim Chowdhury is fantastic, and David Mitchell. Like David Mitchell, in a way, is like the sort of main, the other main character in the film besides Steve's character, and sort of is the sort of, you know, represents kind of us in a way. He's like sort of nice guy who's slightly compromised by, he's being paid by Rich McCree to write his autobiography, and in a sense kind of goes along with, takes the easy path really, whatever that easy path is, takes the easy path. But I love working with David. I think it's brilliantly funny in general, and also really great in this as well.
It's nice with David. I love his work, but people don't often see him doing sort of a more dramatic role, and his character is really complex and he's conflicted, but also you sort of relate to him because you need to get paid.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's great. It's like great to see him in such a major role as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, I think he does it really, really well. Really, really well.
He's a good...
But he's also, I think part of that is that, I think he's got, you know, very subtle. I think, you know, in a sense, I think people, when they think about good actors, they often like to see actors, they often think of good actors being the actors where they're really obviously acting. Mm. And then it's always a bit like, oh, he's just playing himself. And I think they're the really good ones, the ones who are just playing themselves. That's an incredibly subtle thing to do, to sort of be in a role and still be able to bring a lot of yourself to it. That's a kind of more complex job, I think.
Well, that's kind of the sign of, like, pure authenticity. Like, oh, he's just being himself.
Yeah,
so he's working really hard to kind of do that.
Yeah.
There's an art to it. With this, you know, because of the nature of this film, you do get to have the grand party sequence, which is a little bit heightened. I really liked the celebrity cameos you have, where they play sort of the put upon corporate booking type celebrity. And you got Stephen Fry doing that. You also got James Blunt playing his one hit song. Were they up for the?
But both of them in particular, and you know, Fatboy Slim, Pink Slide. So they all came along really in a nice kind of spirit of, like, I think, you know, like, doing it for either nothing or almost nothing, doing it for the fun of doing it, I hope, but also like doing it because, you know, I think they thought, you know, that looking at, you know, inequality would be a good thing to do. So they all sort of slightly send themselves up, you know, and we're kind of happy to do it. And especially for like people like Stephen Norman Cook, Fatboy Slim, and Pixie, who came to the party, those were the very first 2 days of the shoot. And
really?
It was like, and the way that it was organized, because we were like in at the very end of the season with the hotels, because they're incredibly expensive hotels, the only time we could afford was just as they were closing. So we had to be those 2 days. And so, you know, obviously it was the biggest bit of the shoot. It was like hundreds of people and all the cast, everyone had just arrived. So it was pretty chaotic, but they kept put a brave face on it. We're lovely to work with, so it's really sweet of them to do it.
It must be quite fun actually putting on, because in that party scene, it looks like there's hundreds of people on set. It must be quite fun actually. And this is a big film set today. We've got a lot of people here.
Well, yes, but it wouldn't have been the very first 2 days. So it was a bit like, oh, God, yeah. So consequently, in a sense, because it was the whole idea is like party where things are kind of unravel, it was sort of, it felt quite appropriate because it was fairly chaotic. It was basically, okay, let's just like have the party and we'll just kind of run around filming and everyone just like gets going. And we had like, you know, probably 20 actors, you know, besides the subjects, right? Virtually all the cast was there. It was a big cast. So it was a bit like, well, I'm sorry, I don't have time to talk to you today. Just get on with it.
It's quite rare, isn't it, to have like all your main cast in one place at one time.
Yeah, and it was only the film in general was an unusually big cast, yeah, which... Does as a director, does, you know, it's always more complicated when you've got more people to talk to.
You've got and you mentioned earlier you had actually real life refugees taking part in the film. Again, was that something you wanted to do from the offset when you started putting this project together?
Yeah, I mean, the very beginning was obviously refugees were in right at the very beginning. It was all about fashion industry. But then we had the idea of, like, you know, having the party, and then it was like, okay, that in a way, you know, because part of the idea of the film, you know, there's a kind of caption at the front about only connected. Part of the thing is like all these things that seem very separate, like, you know, like I was saying before about, you know, you've got this sort of wealthy billionaire in Monaco and the women working for low wages, that they seem separate but they're connected. It's like, and the, I think, you know, when we go to on holiday to Greek Island or whatever. Mm. Yeah, we know, of course, we know it's like 1.5 million whatever refugees have come across the Mediterranean in the last few years. We know thousands of people have died. We know that 70,000 people roughly are still stuck in Greece trying to find a new life. But we obviously don't want to think about that. We just don't want to, let's not think about that. Let's just lie on the beach and let's, you know, and if there's a refugee camp around the corner, let's just try and switch off from that. You know, and so the idea was that, you know, that they would be like in the party, in trying, you know, they'd be the equivalent in a way of is another group that rich is a kind of, you know, just wants to get out of the way and ignore. And so, I've been going to Greek islands to meet some refugee groups, a couple of different Greek islands before that. And, you know, we enjoyed meeting them. It just felt like, well, obviously, this the best thing and the simplest thing. It would be just to have, you know, get a group of refugees together. So we went through an organization, sort of charity that works in Athens, and we sort of met hundreds of people. And Kareem, who acts the main kind of part in the film, had helped organize the kind of meeting of lots of people. He does like works kind of cultural activities with refugees. He is a refugee, so he's like does cultural activities. And so it kind of seemed like a sense just bringing a group of people along that he'd kind of got together. And they were great to work with. You know, and I think, I hope, you know, that having something to do, you know, it's like, you know, was good for them. It was like one of the terrible things is like how to, you know, just get access to work. Really. Mm.
And he's amazing in the film as well.
He's really good.
It's a surprise at the end when you actually, you know, you say, there's a few captions on screen, but you reveal that he's a real life Russian. Like, wow, he's not an actor.
Yeah. he pops up in the trip to Greece as well.
Oh, really? Oh, nice.
because they're going on this journey in trip to Greece, Stephen Rubb, and they set up from Troy, and then they go into Ithaca. But the sort of first leg is they get the boat across to Lesbos, which is just sort of near Troy. And Lesbos is a huge refugee camp on it. So we have Kareem popping up at the refugee camp, sort of like as a refugee there, and reminding Steve that he'd been working with him on Mykonos the year before. And Steve's like, Who are you? And Steve doesn't remember him, but tries to pretend that he does remember him.
Oh, that's amazing. is it just pure coincidence that but they're both set in Greece? They're both in the projects.
It's not exactly coincidence. It's more that, you know, sort of like, so I say, I think there's probably the first lot of trips were more researching another film about Syrians, but was in Greece meeting refugees. And then I think that, you know, being in Greece, that probably encouraged me to think that trip to Greece would be interesting. It's a great country. You know, it's an amazing country. So it's like, whenever you work at a place, you often kind of end up being drawn back because like something you do in one job kind of spills into another job.
It's a nice organic approach.
Yeah.
What's the reaction to Greed been like so far from, you know, people actually work in the fashion industry?
Well, we had one screening a while ago and everyone seemed to be up for it. And we got screened tonight, to be honest, with, again, people connected with fashion. And I think, you know, I think obviously there's a huge, you know, movement within fashion for ethical fashion, trying to have more ethical fashion. And I'm sure, you know, and if you look, you go on the websites of companies like Zara and H&M, they talk a good game on ethical fashion and, you know, workers' rights and workers' conditions. Mm. You know, but you know, so it's like, I think people in fashion, like everywhere, people, I think, would, you know, be really happy for the world to be a bit fairer. It's like, it's how you achieve that. I think these days, you know, we've had 40 years of like the market's God, the market's dominant. You know, it's just a question of like the market decides everything. I think people are fed up with that generally. I'm sure people in fashion are kind of thinking about ways of making it better. You know, and I think it just needs, in a way, it needs a kind of political action. Just say, okay, like, you know, it's like it's not about one individual company or one individual brand or one individual person, you know, making a choice, or one individual consumer sort of choosing that thing. It's actually just that we've got to say collectively, okay, well, this is wrong, and we'll change it to be a bit more like this.
Absolutely. And I think I think the end of this film does give people a lot to think about, and I'm sure audiences will sort of be taking a closer look, hopefully, at their labels in future.
Cool.
Do you know what you're doing next?
I'm having a sabbatical.
Sounds like a brilliant thing to do. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks.